on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
I plot out the book, but often you get to a point and that something triggers in your head and the plot changes and you do feel a love for the panther side of things. And I'd love to be able to have that freedom to see where a story goes. But for me, I kind of, because time is precious, I have to have that discipline.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to The Self-Publishing Show with me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson.
It's the second show of 2023, but the first show that we're in 2023. So we can say Happy New Year a second time because it feels like we should.
Yes, because we recorded the last one in 2022 when things were bleak and horrible. And things were only marginally less bleak. And actually, they're probably worse, aren't they?
Don't say that. No, everyone says that the whole time.
Well, I was trying to come back. Tell you what, I was coming back from London today with my daughter, as I just mentioned to you off air. And we were staying in the Shard, which is a great big tall skyscraper in London, and looking directly over London Bridge and looking down on the tracks, and there were no trains at all. Zero trains.
Well, strike, aren't they?
There's a strike today, so we had to get a taxi back. So yes, in terms of the bleakometer, it was actually quite bleak.
Got a taxi back from London to Salisbury.
I did, yeah.
So you're so rich.
And there.
Not anymore, though. Well, paid for that time.
I could not as rich. No, I could have got
a helicopter.
Very easily have driven, I suppose, but then I would have had to drive into London, which, to be honest, I didn't fancy much. So, quite happy to have someone do that and just sit in the back and actually work. I was actually able to do some work, which was quite nice, because I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And I'm very busy right now, so I did a very long threaded tweet. I've done a couple of those in the last 2 days. And it's been, quite fun, actually. I'm just kind of thinking about, I know lots of shit, which you kind of you start writing and you think, what can I tweet about? And I think, I don't know about that. And then you kind of know about that. And before you know it, you've got like 15 tweets, which I think is reasonably useful. Talking about reader magnets today and things you can use. Yesterday, I talked about giveaways and actually did a little bit of research and looked at the history of giving something away to generate sales.
I saw that.
Other things.
Pears soap.
It was...
was it not Pears?
William Babbitt. It was Wrigley, Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
I actually found a reference to an innkeeper giving something away a 14th century poem, which is the earliest I could go back. So,
good research.
It was quite... And quite fun.
Just you're going to be like the Confucius of the indie publishing world. They'll be saying, Dawson, he saved first book free.
Possibly confused, but not Confucius.
No, they're very good. The threads are excellent. They're on Twitter, on your personal account, which is at PBackWriter. I will put this up on the screen. So follow at PBackWriter, but also follow self pub form. And I'll retweet them there. And also we're putting on tips. We're trying to do a lot more on social media. And I would love it if you're on TikTok, if you could follow our TikTok account. We have a self-publishing show, TikTok. Account which started, I opened it probably a few weeks ago, but actually started posting this week. So it's always quite hard to get going on these platforms, but there's already some amazing stuff on there. So that's at self-publishing show.
I'm going to try and start doing some stuff on Twitter. And I did, did I mention it last week? I can't remember, but I did a tweet round about Christmas that had 1,300 likes, which is, I suppose that's about as close to being viral as I'm ever going to get. And, just through 10 years of experience. And it would be quite interesting to kind of take those and maybe do 30-second videos on each one, just expanding a little bit about what I was waffling on about. I am not a TikToker particularly, but I've seen more than enough evidence now that what can be done with TikTok. And it would be great if we could start to do a little bit of content for authors who enjoy the platform. So we'll have a chat off air and you can tell me what I need to do.
Yes.
You're the expert. I'm not.
I do enjoy TikTok, I have to say. It's a good environment, fun environment. And there's quite a good community of us there. We all sort of support each other. And I got a nice little reply from D2D, who are on TikTok, welcoming us to contribute to Indie. And then I got
D2D, James, for those who don't know.
Is Drafter Digital, an aggregator, someone who I'm going to be using very soon for my first giveaway book, because I'm exclusive with Amazon in my first two books. Book three will be not in KU. And so I'm actually going to use D2D. I think I will talk about strategy, and I'll ask you some questions about that near the time. So that book's just gone off to proof, the final stage. So I'm really close to releasing that. I'm excited about. Hey, look, before we go any further, can we welcome our Patreon supporter?
Oh, yes. Well done. That's very good.
Do you know where it is? I've got it if you don't.
No, I don't. You can do it.
It's Zach Thout. Thout. I'm going to say Thout. T-H-O-U-T-T. Zach Thout. It's quite a good name, actually. Hey, Zach Thout. You're from Colorado, yes. USA.
Thank you, Zach. Yeah, I'm just trying to find his name so I can and check. But oh, yes, Zach Thout. Yes, I see. From Colorado.
So Zach,
yes,
thank you, Zach. Joined us on Patreon. We're going to try and rejig our Patreon this year and make it a nice, attractive thing to do. But thank you very much indeed for supporting the show. It means a lot to us. And you do get some goodies for being a part of that.
Naked pictures of Blatch.
Naked pictures of me, obviously. I send them whether they want them or not. I probably shouldn't say that anymore, actually. It's a technical offence. And obviously, we're joking. And yes, the other thing I think we need to say before we go any further is we are 2 days into our challenge. Well, at the point this is released, we are 2 days into our Facebook challenge. So if you've not got into Facebook ads yet, or you're not got them working for you, this could be a really good thing for you to do with everybody else as we learn Facebook ads together from the beginning, take those first tentative steps in. For me, it's still a hugely important platform for selling books. And to take part in it, we're 2 days in, but you can catch up with the videos very quickly and easily if you go to the Facebook group. We're doing everything through a Facebook group, and a quick link to get there is selfpublishingformula.com/Facebook challenge, all one word. That'll take you straight to the group. Click join. One of our many little squirrels will admit you into the group very quickly, and you can get on with that. So we're doing that this week. Hey, I had a BookBub, my first ever featured deal for one of my own books. I've run them before for Fuse Books, and I've seen the power of them, but I was blown away. I think I meant to look this up, but knocking on 30,000 downloads in all, so 26,000, 27,000, something like that. And it immediately it had an effect in different areas straight away. So first of all, I sold loads of print versions of the book on the same day. And astonishingly, I sold 80 audio versions of Final Flight in December, and 60 of those were that day and the next day that the BookBub featured deal went out. So it's not just, and that's important because they're £3.77 each for me royalties on average, those are audio books. So you times that by 60 and you're starting to easily cover you at the expense of the BookBub, let alone the sales you're going to get as a result in the days and weeks that follow. And the days and weeks that followed, I've just had a fantastic week. You know, I've only got two books out. I mean, I'm very open with my figures, and I did a big post into the group actually at Christmas or New Year if people want to see how the last year went for me. Actually, I think I posted into the 20 books group.
You did, yeah. You posted to the wrong group. But
yeah.
It's a group. Like, but you should definitely post into our group.
Yeah, I will as well to share those figures. But I've just had a really brilliant week of sort of, I think, £700, about £500 profit. Once I take away my Facebook ad spend. But my Facebook ad spend hasn't changed, so this must be just the tale of the BookBub coming in. Now, I'm in my audience. If you read this thread, which I will post, I'll make sure it's there by Friday into our community group, I'm sort of refocusing on audience building, which I've lost my way a little bit, really trying to show off by making a profit by employing your Facebook ads tactics, which I've mastered in some way here and there. But I really need to be building audience again. So my third book is going to be a giveaway. It's gone off to proof now, as I say. And that will be backing out this month. That will be wide. I might even, you're going to hate this, but I might even dabble in AI audio for it. Because one of my friends...
Don't hate it.
Yeah, one of my friends has just done one of her books. A full-length novel cost her, I think, $450. To have an AI voice on it, and it was pretty good. I played it to a few friends over Christmas at parties. And what do you think of this? And it took them a little while to think, is it an AI? You can tell.
Well, as we record this, there's a story in The Guardian today, which you might have missed.
I don't read The Guardian.
I know you don't, but it's actually gone wider than that. Apple has released their kind of AI-assisted audiobook creation. So Google and Apple do it now. And I listened to the Apple examples, two of them today, and they're good. They are. I mean, I I probably wouldn't use it. If I wouldn't use it because I have a narrator I love, and my readers love him, and actually more than and Gemma Whelan from Game of Thrones does the Beatrix books, and she does a great job too. So I would not use an AI because I think we're not at the stage yet where they can do a performance that is anywhere near on the level with the professional narrator. But saying that, these are really good. They don't sound, you know, that kind of uncanny valley. It doesn't really sound like that. The only thing that gives it away is things like intonation is a little bit standard and constant, and the kind of there's a regularity about the way that they read the words that is a little not robotic, but it's just too kind of metronomic. But you're saying that they're really good, and I think for shorter books, or I think it'd be hard to spot the difference. This is still reasonably early.
Yeah.
So, you know, we post about this. I've posted a couple of things in the group about this and things that might happen over the next 18 months. I'm not worried about authors because I don't think we are anywhere near the stage where an AI can write a book in the way that that we can, with, you know, with depth of character and everything that goes along with a really exciting read. But I think cover design and stuff is getting a little bit, you know, is getting I'll be a little bit itchy about that. And AI for voice, I think is quite well ahead, fueled by things like Alexa and all the home assistants that we've been having for the last 5 years. So, you know, we will see. I was actually on Joanna Penn's podcast, and this will go out after I was on Joe's podcast. We had a good chat about that. And I think speaking as a retired lawyer, there needs to be, and there will be, a very big case that looks into how this is affecting copyright.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to art. I think what's happening is it's kind of trawling
Van Gogh and
things. Well, no, anything it can find, you know. I've seen posts from artists who have identified their style.
Yes.
The style that they've worked for 10 years developing and kind of making their own. So it's identifiably theirs. The AIs are just picking that off and they're making new things. So not really breaching the copyright. They're not copying, but very...
Well, it's derivative, which all art is,
very,
ultimately.
Very derivative. So at some point, there is going to be a reckoning, and it's going to be a very expensive and confusing case where the law, which is probably 5 years behind anyway, even before we look at AI, is going to have to try and wrestle some sense into this.
Joe Penn, you mentioned, and the Creative Pen podcast, our very good friend over there. She's very into this area, has been talking about it for years.
She has.
And there's always been a little bit of we're not there yet with a lot of these areas. So it's interesting to hear you talking about the voice. I mean, Cecilia Mecca, I'll give her, Bella Michaels writes her contemporary romance, and she used it and sent me some clips. And I think for my novella, I think I'm with you. I want particularly cult, you know, I write historical novels, and there's a human, like Matt Addis narrated my first book, and he was brilliant at just picking up the way people spoke slightly differently in the 1960s and today. I'm not convinced the computer's going to do that very well, but for a novella that I'm giving away and therefore, you know, as kind of lost leader, I think it's definitely something I will try. If you're
AI, I wouldn't.
An AI narrator.
It's got to be good. It's not. You're not doing this.
True. Yes, I know what you're saying.
But you want it to be the best it can
be. I suppose what I mean is a short book, and it's an experiment for me to see what it sounds. If it's not good, I'm not going to use it, obviously. But I don't know if you've been on ChatGPT. Have you tried it out?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
So I was watching someone today, actually, who asked it to write an episode of Seinfeld where George becomes the managing director of the New York Yankees. It did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
You know, it's not there. It's a long way from, you know, you wouldn't record that episode, but you would give it to a writer and say, here's an idea, work with this. And that's the thing.
It's good for ad copy. I mean, I asked it to generate 10 Facebook headlines for Facebook ads, and it did a really, really good job. I would have used them without changing a word.
Wow.
So that was, I mean, that's only like 8 words. So you give it something to start with and say variations on that, please. And it did a really, really good job. It's also pretty good on blurbs, you know, and not, it needs not to the extent that you can actually use them, but I gave it, What did I do? I think I gave it some. I said, this is a story about X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. Can you write me a blurb and make it punchy, exciting, whatever? And it did a really good job. And it needed work.
Yeah. That's a good
as
start.
As a starting point, it was very acceptable.
Well, on this front, by the way, if you don't know what we're talking about, ChatGPT is an open AI program that you can. It's got a playground, it's called, that you can play with, so you can type in these questions, get answered, and ask it to do things. It's at chat.openai.com. Although I have noticed the last few days, it seems to be busy to capacity, so you don't get in.
It often is. When the big story broke a couple of weeks ago, you couldn't really use it.
Right. It's the first time I've tried to use it in a couple of weeks. That's probably why today. I mean, Stuart Bache, our cover designer, has actually meddled with this. And he's struggled, I think, to write himself and have the ideas. And so he's found this useful to get his writing going, not to write it for him, but to say, you know, we're in a forest and you're confronted by a witch, and then let it write a paragraph or two to spark your ideas. And he's using the actual source code to create a little tool to help writers like that. He's trying that out. I know he's floated the idea.
We'll do an episode on AI because it is impressive if you get someone who knows a bit more than we do. But I mean, it is, you can use it for all kinds of things. You know, prompts. I said, look, give me 5 topics for blog posts on Facebook ads. And it did, you know, titles that you could then work off. It was pretty good. It's interesting times.
I'll have to look at how much it costs to upgrade so you can actually skip this queue.
Can you pay them? I don't know if you
can. Set up a paid account.
Okay.
Personal.
Not for the podcast, James.
I'm going to do it all live. Okay, right. Let's move on to our interviewee. We've got obviously lots to talk about because we haven't been together for a while. Let's move on anyway to our interviewee, who is the winner of the Kindle Storyteller Award. We both met him in London, and it was a bit of a surprise because we looked at, was it 5 books nominated, I think? And I would have thought Peter Gibbons was the outsider just looking at genres. Nothing to do with the quality of the books, but the genre was a little bit more sort of Viking, and he was up against mainstream romance, thriller, whodunit, LGBT romance.
I've been a judge twice for the Kindle Storyteller Awards, and we weren't affected by the genre. At least when I did it, it was all fairly meritocratic. So it was kind of which was the most interesting book. So I think one year we did Anna McNuff, and that was
a
book on travel, was really, really excellent book, really well written. I know what you mean. It's coming from a less popular genre than some of the others, but you know, I think what they would have done is looked at was the best book regardless of genre. And he won,
and the judges were walking around saying that it was the book that they probably thought, am I going to enjoy this as a judge? I've got to read this. And they all became absolutely absorbed with it and loved it. So anyway, Peter's a lovely guy, lives in Ireland, from the northwest of England, but I caught up with him a couple of weeks ago, and this is Peter.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Peter Gibbons, welcome to The Self-Publishing Show. We met in Parliament. Sounds very posh, doesn't it? But we met. It was a posher night for you than it was for me, even though I enjoyed it, because you were crowned the Kindle Storyteller Award winner, which was fantastic. Just tell me about that moment when they announced the winner.
Yeah, it was kind of a bit surreal, James. And thanks, obviously, for having me on as well. It's great to be with you. But it was one of those things where I was invited to the ceremony. I never for a second thought I was going to win, because there's lots of fabulous authors that were shortlisted. And I don't know whether you noticed at the time, but everybody was kind of a crime author, which is kind of a huge genre. I was the only historical fiction author on the shortlist. So I never expected to win, but I went over and enjoyed it. It was, like you say, it was at the Houses of Parliament. So it was completely something that you'd never do again in your life. So I enjoyed the drinks and had a relax and had a few drinks with the other shortlisted authors before we went, and Barry and a few other, J.D. Kirk and a few of the other guys who were really friendly. I was with my wife and we went down and tried to relax, and it was brilliant. And then when the Amazon guys kind of read out my name, I was completely surprised. And it was funny because my wife was actually videoing me, because we were laughing beforehand saying, we should try and do one of those faces for the crack. You know, the Oscars where you have to pretend that you're happy for everyone.
Yeah, you have maybe to rehearse like that.
Yeah, do a miserable face just for a bit of fun or something, you know. But obviously, when they announced I was the winner, it was kind of, I was gobsmacked. But yeah, it was amazing. I was delighted to win. It's been an amazing experience. So yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And you write historical fiction, but also fantasy. And is that fair? Is it fantasy is what you'd call your...
It is. Yeah. So I probably released my first book probably September last year. And the first series is kind of Viking historical fiction. But the most recent book I released there was kind of a passion project for me, which is like historical fantasy. So I love fantasy and I love historical fiction. So it's kind of a melding of the two. But the book I released recently is set like way back in history in kind of ancient times, kind of classical history. But it's kind of cool releasing something new in a slightly different genre because you get to go through all the, well, if you find it exciting, like I do, all the kind of marketing stuff and trying to get out to new readers and new genres and research and ads and promotion and all of that stuff, which is good.
We know that readers fall into, certainly with the romance subgenres, they can fall into quite neat groups, and they don't have a lot of overlap. So you have to be careful with what you put in a book so you don't confound the expectation of somebody who's bought it. But I'm wondering, so I write historical fiction, but mine's 1960s, Cold War, and I couldn't bring in any kind of fantasy or magic to that. Would be ridiculous, and I'd turn my readers off. But Vikings are so far back, you know, even further back than Game of Thrones era, that I wonder if it's an easier movement for some of your readers. Did you find you carried some of your historical fiction readers over to the fantasy?
Yeah, it's probably a bit early to say because the fantasy book is only out maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And this week, really, I start all the promotion. I've done the stuff kind of with my newsletter and with the Facebook, kind of Facebook followers trying to see. But I wrote the historical fantasy book ages ago, which was probably the first or second book, but I sat on it precisely for that reason. I was worried that I'd perhaps alienate the people who are kind of more hardcore. They want the history to be right and factual and all of that kind of stuff. Whereas with the fantasy, it's a little bit more kind of Games of Thrones-y in that it's set in an actual period of time, but obviously with elements of magic in it. And I can almost see it now with some of the reviews that are coming in. You can see that perhaps people who would staunchly give you a 5-star review are now perhaps giving you a 3 or a 4. So I think now, like, I've got a lot of the kind of advertising and promotion is starting this week, which is purely geared at a completely new audience, a fantasy type audience.
Yeah.
And I'm really hoping that they're going to, the reviews and the much better reviews are going to flow through. But the people that like the Viking history books, and I think that's the part of the reason it's been so successful for me. But people who like the Viking stories are there's a particular cultural element there of people that like Viking, especially in the US. The books were really kind of did really well for me in the US. And I think there's kind of there's a thing there that US people kind of feel that synergy, or people of European roots or whatever it might be, like that kind of Viking, that time and a lot of the elements that go with that, you know, the Scandinavian people taking to the seas and blood and gore and all that. Whereas the historical fantasy book is a bit more kind of Alexander the Great, you know, the Persian Empire kind of times. So it's completely different. So there's no axe throwing or kind of blokes with big beards taken to the wild seas. It's a bit more
horned helmets.
Yeah. But it's kind of, what I'm almost trying to do is kind of broaden my reach to kind of different. So I imagine a lot of the people that are going to read the historical fantasy novel is perhaps there's not that much crossover between the Viking historical fiction.
Which always brings us back to that point about negative reviews or poorer reviews are nearly always a reader not saying this isn't a great book. I mean, they think they might be saying that, but what they really mean is this is not what I expected it to be. And so you have to be ever so careful with that, don't you? But I think heavy marketing with a very clear, this is fantasy book, is the right way of doing it.
Yeah, completely. And being really clear with the cover, being really clear to your mailing list about what it is and why it's different. But like that, you're always going to get a lot of the staunch guys, which is great, who are going to support you and read the book. And they might not like it as much as they do. Like the Viking series is continuing.
Right.
I have another Viking book on pre-order. That's just to finish in editing now. That'll be out in January. So I'll continue with that. It's just the fantasy stuff is something that I'm equally as passionate about, and I had the book written, and I kind of toyed with the idea of using a different pen name or sitting on it again for another year. But you know, when you have the thing written and it's ready to go, you kind of want to get it out there, you know.
Yeah. So what difference do you think first of all, tell us, what did you win with this Kindle Storyteller Award?
What, the prize?
Yeah.
The prize is there's a cash prize, which is £20,000.
Nice.
And also then you kind of get a marketing support package from Amazon. So Amazon will help promote your book. So the book that won was King of War, which is the fourth book in the Viking Blood and Blade saga. Amazon put a lot of support then behind that book. So beyond what you would normally get for the kind of the things they would do for you anyway, the 99p offers and that kind of thing, and how they'd push you in Kindle Unlimited. So they're doing a lot, like there's a thing that will happen shortly, like an editor's pick for the book,
right,
and different bits and pieces. But yeah, so the award was kind of twofold. So it's a cash prize, but also the marketing support.
Yeah. And you were, or you still sort of are at the moment, full-time employee somewhere, but that's changing.
That's changing. Yeah. So we're on the back of winning the award, but all the books themselves, sales have been successful enough probably for the last 3 or 4 months to warrant going full-time, but you've got the fear, because I've a wife and 3 kids and responsibilities, you know, so you don't want to go off on a kind of chaotic passion project and not be able to pay your mortgage, you know. So but with the winning the award, I thought now was a good time to leave the day job behind and go off, and because it's a dream, obviously, when you write your first book, A, you're not sure if 1 people or 2 people are going to read it, and B, that you'll be able to make a living from it. So I'm absolutely thrilled that that's proved to be the case. And I've got about 4 weeks left of my notice period before I'll be a full-time author. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've read your job title somewhere. You're relatively senior, are you not?
I'm global head of sales for a big international private medical insurance company. Yeah.
Wow. I think it might be the big insurance company. My brother-in-law is quite senior in as well. We'll have a conversation off air, so if you know each other.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. A German-based insurance company.
That's exactly
company.
Right. Yeah.
That's a bigger move than most, because often you do hear people who basically do a day job that supports them whilst they're trying to write. But you've had a full-on career, doing very well. And I imagine they probably were sorry to see you go. You probably have some conversations about what might be in the future for you in a big organization like that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'd always thought that would be my career, that I'd keep pushing on. I relocated to Ireland, gosh, what would it be, 17 years ago now, and I've kind of risen up through the financial services ranks. And I, like you say, I'm in a fairly senior position now, and I thought my career would always kind of pan out that way. It was only really when I discovered, I'd always wanted to be a writer and love reading and history and all the things you normally hear. And I wrote my first book and did all the, invested in myself a little bit in terms of understanding story structure and blah, blah, blah. So I had the book written, and it was only really when I'd sent it off to a few agents and things like that and received nothing or rejections. And it was only really when I turned over the stone of self-publishing, because obviously you're not born understanding the self-publishing world. It's something you need to be exposed to and understand. It was only when I began to understand it that I saw the possibility of it. And I spent a lot of time trying to understand it and learn the different nuances and the different elements you need to try and make your book a success. And I put the first book out there and it went really well. And it was only a couple of months into that journey that the flame started to kindle in my head that becoming a full-time writer might be a possibility. And since that time, I've kind of pursued it aggressively. So I've been getting up early mornings, working weekends, trying to keep writing books. So I was able to get 4 books out over the first 12 months, which is important.
Wow.
Build the reader list through the website, really, really get a solid grasp on Amazon ads and BookBub ads and all the different things you need to try and make yourself a success, writing a blurb, cover. There's a lot of elements. I mean, you guys know better than others. I listen to your podcast, right? But there are a lot of things you've got to learn and understand. You can release your book and it'll just die a death. And it's not that you, and luckily for me, I enjoy that side of it as well. I enjoy the sales and marketing side. But yeah, it's been great. It's been a great journey. And now to become a full-time writer is kind of a dream come true. And hopefully it lasts and I don't have to go back to my employer begging bowl in hand in 12 months' time, you know.
Do you think you'll stay in Ireland? It sounds to me maybe from the northwest of the UK.
Yeah, I'm from Warrington originally. Warrington. Yeah, just in between Liverpool and Manchester. Yeah. So yeah, my wife is Irish. My kids are growing up here, and we live in the countryside in County Kildare. So it's kind of, it's nice. And I'm building an office out in the back garden now where I'll be based. So no, I'll definitely stay in Ireland. It's kind of, This is kind of where I live now. And
also,
it's a nice place to be. It's a nice place to be located. It's nice and safe. And
yeah,
no, I love living here. Yeah.
And quite a good business environment.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's good for different reasons. It's good as an author. There are kind of tax benefits to living in Ireland. There's an artist exemption you can avail of, which is an interesting kind of an interesting facet to kind of consider when you want to become a full time author or you start earning money from it. Obviously, is how your income is taxed. So any kind of exemptions or benefits you can get like that help. And that's really what made the jump full time a little bit more possible. He's trying to get a grasp and an understanding of that side of it.
Yeah.
And I like that. You hear it often on your different podcasts that you guys do. The writing of the book is only one element of your career, and tax and income is as important as marketing and the writing itself.
You've got to love a good spreadsheet, haven't you?
Unfortunately, now, yeah, you
do. I do love a good spreadsheet. So when did you become aware of self-publishing, and then how did you teach yourself?
So I kind of started the journey. I'd always wanted to write a book, and I'd always been interested in kind of that kind of Viking period of time and the invasion of England and blah, blah, blah. And I wrote a manuscript, which I thought was great, and it turned out to be rubbish. And I invested in kind of a manuscript assessment kind of program, like a structural edit, for want of a better word. And I got the edit and it came back, and that kind of blew my mind and introduced me to things like story structure and three acts and Save the Cat and all that. And so went off then learning about all of that, kicked the manuscript into shape, killed off a couple of characters, kill your darlings, as it were, sent the thing off to a few agents, heard nothing back. But at that time, then I discovered self-publishing, because I read all the time myself on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited, and it only clicked with me at that time that a lot of the books I was reading were self-published authors. So then I kind of delved into that, and really the internet, obviously, and your podcast, the stuff you can see, and access on YouTube. There are different things like the stuff that you guys put out, the Kindlepreneur, and all different things where you can learn about how to upload your book, how to format your manuscript, but even before that, about how to write your blurb and what your cover should look like. So I invested a lot of time in that. It's funny, actually, after I released my first book, an American guy has a YouTube channel, made a YouTube video about the blurb for my first book, kind of taking it apart, which was kind of great for me because I spent so much time on it,
right,
making sure that all the elements were right. So, you know, if you like books by X, Y, and Z, you're going to love this book because it's got ABC in it, and all those kind of hooks to try to get readers in. And the cover for the first book, I kind of ummed and ahed about. And in the end, I found a brilliant cover designer on Upwork. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you
get like Fiverr.com.
Exactly.
Yeah. Marketplace, yeah.
Exactly. But what I really wanted was something that if you saw it, you would immediately see that, you immediately understand that it was kind of a Viking book, it's axes and a shield on it, you know.
Yeah.
So getting those basics right. And then I was kind of geared up then. I had kind of my keywords ready, my categories ready. I invested a lot of time using different tools like Publisher Rocket, where you can kind of trawl and see where you should be with your categories. So understanding all that. Then get the thing live, run through some promo sites, which I'm doing again now for the book I'm just releasing. So you can use a service called BookRank, who you can pay, and that they'll put you through to different, all the big different mailing lists like Fussy Librarian and BookBaby and all those things. Try and get some promos out there, reduce the price of the book. This is all the stuff I did for the first book. Get lots of people to download it and start reading it. And once you've got kind of 10 reviews, that's when you really start kicking in with the ads. So I do and still do now run Facebook, Amazon ads and BookBub ads. Yeah, but most of the investment is in Amazon ads, because you can really drill down in terms of and be specific in terms of competitors you want to target, keywords you want to target. So learning about all that, I probably spent 6 to 12 months learning about all that. So I was ready that when I released the first book that I could start following that plan and kick it off. And luckily it did. And I was really surprised. I think I ran it free for the first couple of weeks.
Right.
Lots of downloads from that. And then the reviews started coming in, and then I started running the ads. And once you get in that kind of, you start surfing that wave of the kind of Amazon algorithm, you kind of get brought along then, and your requirement for doing all the extra things reduces, and you can really survive then on the embrace of Amazon and your basic Amazon, Facebook and BookBub ads. That's kind of the way I do it, and it's worked. And I still, most of the ads I invest in are for the first book. So yeah, you get the follow through then through the rest of the series. But there's so much you can learn, and you guys run a brilliant course on it. There are a lot of courses out there, but it is, I would recommend to anybody listening or watching to invest in yourself. Invest in, so you might have written the best book in the world. If you stick it up there without investing in that stuff, it'll just die. Yeah. And equally, you could have a book that's fairly mediocre, but if you understand all those different elements, you can really take it somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Peter. Appreciate that. And I see that in terms of strategy, you'd keep, is The Wrath of Ivar is number one in your series?
Number two.
That's number two.
First one.
Okay. So I noticed that's at 99p.
Yeah. So that's just an Amazon. So every so often, through Prime Reading, I get emails from Amazon and that they'll run a campaign. So I've been fortunate in that in any month, there's always one or two Amazon-based campaigns running either in the US or the UK, either generally a 99p offer or something like that. Like the book I won the award for, King of War, was just on offer for the last month. And I have a few offers running through Amazon. Amazon are running I think post or pre-Christmas for 12 days of Christmas or something. So I have two books discounted for that period as well.
Right. That's nice. And I'm guessing George R.R. Martin is one of your sort of target authors, or who else do you target?
Yeah, the main one would be Bernard Cornwell, who writes The Last Kingdom that was on TV. So he'd be the main guy. But obviously, the cost per click on a Bernard Cornwell keyword is massive. So you really want to drill down and find kind of more targetable contemporaries. So people in the UK like Matthew Harvey, Tim Hodkinson, real historical fiction, Viking guys, try and target those guys. That's really where you'd spend most of your keywords. And then also, anything to do with Game of Thrones. Keywords then around anything to do with the Viking TV series. I'd kind of have campaigns then. I'd run Amazon ads campaigns based around particular competitors, based around particular keywords. And like you say, unfortunately, the spreadsheet, as much as your Word document or whatever it is you're writing, your Excel spreadsheet does need to be your best friend.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm making notes from you now because I've decided, looking at your blurbs, I'm going to put my comp authors in the top line. If you like Tom Clancy, you'll love James Scratch. It helps with search terms as well, doesn't it?
I think it does. I just think if people are looking and they see your book and you say that you like X, Y, or Z, if you like this person, you're kind of making that sale to the reader, or that guarantee that if they read your book, they're going to read something broadly similar. So I like to, like I normally use somebody like David Gemmell, who's a great fantasy author. And I like to think if you read one of my books, there would be a similar amount of action in as you would get in a David Gemmell book. And equally, I use Bernard Cornwell because he's kind of the master of historical fiction in terms of action, you know, an adventure historical fiction. Which is kind of what I write. So I like to think with those names, once people read the book, they know what they're buying into. And I think that kind of works. And then you've got to have your little hook at the bottom, you know, which is unforgettable characters or blood and gore or whatever it might be for your particular genre that's going to. But the blurb is huge, as important, I think, as the cover.
Yeah. And again, getting the right readers is so important.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And like that, getting the right readers in, if you're Amazon only, which I am, for my self-published books, then you really want to get as many, like I make as much on Kindle Unlimited page reads as through actual ebook sales. So it's really important that I think a lot of readers, if they're getting something on Kindle Unlimited, it can just sit there on their Kindle and they don't read. Well, what you really want is obviously the read. You want the page read. So you want that somebody sees your book, they download it, but then they're also going to read it and keep reading it. So, you've got to hook the reader in with your promotional materials, your cover, your blurb, but obviously then you need your book needs to be good as well then, you know?
Yeah. So you had a few books written before, including, you said, your fantasy book, but this series, was that planned out? I mean, you're five books into it now. Was this planned out from the beginning, or did you just write book one? And
I wrote book one and I always hoped it would be a series. So I set it at a time. which is kind of 865 AD, where a lot of stuff happens in the next kind of 30 or 40 years around Europe. And that's kind of what happens. So the main characters kind of are able to go on this odyssey around the Viking world, meeting all these kind of exciting Vikings with kind of cool names and different locations. So they can go from Anglo-Saxon England to Norway to Denmark to what is now Russia. They haven't yet, but they can go all the way down then to kind of the Arab world and all those different things and southern Spain. And so there's opportunities there for kind of a long series. And the books are kind of, they're adventure books, which kind of lends itself well to a series. So you kind of have a gang who are on board a ship and they all have different characters and relationships. And what I try and do is try and find that macro event. So like in the first book, it's kind of the great heathen army invades England. But within that, then you've got your own kind of fictional characters who are operating within that historical setting. And that then translates itself to the different events of the period. So I wrote the first book just to try and see if I could make something of it and see if people, you know yourself, when you write the first book, 90% of you thinks that's rubbish. Yeah. Nobody's going to like it. And then when people do actually start reviewing it and liking it, it's amazing. And that really then spurs you on to keep going and write more, and people love the characters and all of that. But I think if you said you were planning out, you know, a 10 or 15 book series when you write your first book, I think you'd be probably fooling yourself, because if your first book tanked, you'd be kind of doing it for vanity, you know. And I really wanted to see, first of all, if people would buy it and read it and enjoy it, which they did. But luckily I did pick that period of time, which does lend itself to a series.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously done well. How do you react, interact with your readers? You have a Facebook group and a mailing list?
Yeah, I have a mailing list. So again, that was one of the key elements I kind of learned when I was educating myself on the whole process. So I set up a website, set up a mailing list, simple mailing list using MailChimp, which I still use. I actually launched a new website there a couple of months ago. So that's important. Then I have a Facebook page. And with that, then we're able to do Instagram. One of the big challenges with trying to balance writing with a full-time job is I always feel like I'm only doing maybe 10 or 15% of the stuff that I want to be doing on that side of it, in terms of engaging with readers and doing all the extra things you know you should be doing. Yeah, but it's kind of hard when you're doing all your writing early in the morning, you're working full time, you've got three kids, trying to fit everything in around that. So when I do go full time now in a few weeks, that's the bit that I'm really going to focus on, is that reader engagement, using all the different platforms properly. I know you guys are listening to some of your podcasts. Geez, it must have been 8 months ago. You guys were focusing on TikTok. That's something I need to look at. I don't do enough on Twitter. So generally at the moment, it's kind of Facebook, the mailing list. I do a kind of a monthly newsletter. But yeah, there's a huge opportunity for me to do more there.
Yeah, well, that'd be exciting to see what the first few days you might find you've got all this time, and then very quickly that will disappear and you'll be as busy as you were before. But so that was a hard period for you with a full-time job. I mean, I noticed September 21, book one came out of this 5-book series so far, plus your fantasy book. And that's just over 12 months ago. That's a hell of a time period. And tell us about your sort of typical day during that period.
So what I do, I kind of get up around 5:30, and I'm a plotter, not a pantser, right? So I kind of have a plan already, and I target myself to write 2,000 words a day, which I do. So I generally know, I kind of, before I write the book, I have an idea of what's going to happen. So I try and plan it out. I try and plan out each chapter, what needs to happen in each chapter. Then alongside that, I do kind of a character arc then for each of the major characters, what's going to happen to them. So everything is kind of clear in my head of what needs to happen when. Then in the evening, I'll kind of have a quick look at what I've got to write the next morning and make sure I'm clear. I get up. I get my 2,000 words done, and then the kids start waking up and I start getting ready for work then. And then if I need to, then in the evening, I'll go back in and either finish that word count or focus on some marketing bits and pieces. And I do that every day. And generally then, if you stick to that kind of 2,000 word goal, I mean, some days it's less and some days it's more. On a tough day when you're writing kind of a complex chapter, it could be 1,000 words and you'd be happy with that, you know. And another day you might get 3,000 out in the same time. It just depends. And even though I say I'm a plotter, I plot out the book, but often as you probably well know yourself, you get to a point and that something triggers in your head and the plot changes. And I do kind of then, you do feel a love for the Panther side of things. And I'd love to be able to have that freedom to see where a story goes. But for me, I kind of, because time is precious, I have to have that discipline of being able to, because I think as part of the kind of the bubbling cauldron of self-publishing success is being able to release frequently.
Yeah.
I think readers want that. And I think if you'd only release in a book a year, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
And I think really you need to be able to at least three or four a year, I think, if you can, and be on point with your pre-orders. I think people like to finish a book and know that there's another one. So if they're invested in your characters, but know that there's another one coming down the pipeline. So I've tried to be kind of ruthless and focus on that.
Yeah. So you've got this fifth one, I think, on pre-order, you said, in that series. And what is your plan for the next 12 months with the fantasy book? Would that be a series?
It will if people like it. So I love that story. It's kind of the classical period for me would be a real, be something I've always been passionate about, the time of Alexander, the time of ancient Persia and all the different things that happened then. And the fantasy element of that is that the characters in it are kind of immortal characters who are able to kind of travel through time to different parts of history. And it's kind of a battle like darkness versus light and all that kind of thing. And what the idea is that these characters will be able to travel through different points in history as part of that kind of ongoing battle. Hopefully people like it and the series can continue. But obviously when you're a writer, you've got the business side of it as well, and it needs to drive income. So hopefully the first book drives enough income to warrant a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth. But if it doesn't, I'll focus on the pure historical fiction.
Yeah.
Because even though we'd love to do it for fun, you also there's also a business side of it as well, right?
Yeah. Have you got ideas in mind for future series? Would you carry on with that that Viking series, or would you start a new one?
No, I'd keep going with the Viking series, yeah, but I've lots of ideas. I think that's the beauty of historical fiction is you kind of have, the well is kind of endless, you can dip into. Like I'm a huge fan of that Viking time. Like one of the catalysts for the first book was my wife and I went on a trip to they have this Viking ship museum outside Copenhagen you can go to, where they kind of dug up this fully preserved Viking warship, and you can go and see it, and we did, and it's huge, and that's kind of inspiring. That was kind of one of the triggers for the first book. But I also love kind of Crusades, Middle Ages, and like I say, classical history. There's the Spartans, so the kind of well to dip into for future series is deep. So yeah. I have lots of ideas, and hopefully I can keep it going. But what I'm particularly excited about going full time is to keep writing the existing series, but also explore things that I love, like that ancient history and other things, and also spend more time on marketing.
Yeah, that sounds brilliant. The Copenhagen thing. I think that, isn't there, while friends of mine visited Stockholm recently and said there was something similar there. They described it as being, I think it's still in the harbour and they've sort of built something above it.
Yeah, the Roskilde it's called, outside Copenhagen. And they found this huge ship in a burial mound, and the actual wood from the ship was cut from a forest in Glendalough in Ireland.
Right.
In County Wicklow.
Wow.
Yeah. So while the Vikings, because they were in Ireland, obviously, they cut the timber, formed the ship, sailed it up to Denmark and buried the thing in the ground with some sort of Viking war leader in there.
That's like Sutton Hoo in here in East Anglia.
Exactly like that. Exactly like that, yeah. And then they have a reconstructed version of the ship. But obviously what they can glean from that in terms of the craftsmanship, but also the danger. If you imagine, like, you know, for the likes of myself and yourself, like if you have a job, or say in those times you're a farmer, it's nice and safe. Somebody comes to you with an idea. Let's take this pretty shallow ship and we'll sail it across the North Sea and see what the crack is. See if we can get a few bags of silver. You know, it's almost unthinkable. And that's kind of what's inspiring about it, is the daring of these guys, the bravery. You know, it's obviously there's the flip side of the coin is the violence and all that stuff. But I think it's such a different way of thinking to what we have now in modern times, that they were able to do that and have that courage. I think that's why people love reading those stories, because it's something so alien to us sailing to a land that you or nobody's ever seen before, even though it's relatively close, having all the adventures that they had. It's
just feel like a different planet, doesn't it? And when did this interest, was this since school or?
Yeah, since school, I kind of was always interested in history. And on reflection, I wished I'd done history at university, but I didn't. I did law, and that kind of led me into the kind of thrilling world of insurance. But when you look back, you'd wish you'd done. And I always, in my spare time, I've always read and studied history.
Right.
Read a lot of historical fiction, but also read a lot of historical nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And I'd always wanted to be a writer, and it was always an ambition for me. And like that, it's a bit like the little catchphrase you guys have at the start of the podcast. You know, the audio that plays at the start, yeah, around the barriers being removed.
Yeah.
When you understand that, and it becomes mind blowing that you can write your book. It's relatively simple to produce it. It's relatively simple to get the thing up on Amazon, and if people like it, they can buy it and enjoy your work. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Back to the Vikings then. Let me ask you a couple of questions about them, because you're obviously probably a bit of an expert on this subject through your various delvings. The popular conception, or perception, I should say, is that the raping and pillaging hordes who came over here and ransacked villages, took what they wanted, had their way with whoever they wanted. Is that really true, or is that mythology? I mean, was there a more civilized...
There's kind of different schools of thought on that. I think in the modern age, we like to think of them more as kind of merchants, and obviously the Viking culture was a rich culture. The kind of Norse mythology was a big part of what they believed in, but there were no churches. It was a completely different way of thinking. But they were very much that the gods they worshipped were kind of violent gods, and it was very much a different world. So when they came to England, they brought that culture with them, and it was kind of a mixture of everything. So the first guys that came here who raided Lindisfarne off Northumbria in the northeast, that was very much a violent raid where they couldn't believe that there was a church there with silver and gold in it and no warriors to guard it. It was just priests. Because obviously for the English people, there was no need to have any warriors there because nobody would think of attacking a church. So suddenly, if you land there and you're a big, hairy Norwegian or Danish guy, it's like a gift, you know?
And you're not scared of going to hell because you don't subscribe to that belief system.
It's not a thing. It's a good thing for you to show your bravery and your daring. And if you die, you're going to die in battle, you're going to go to Valhalla, right?
Right.
But with that then, with the raiding and the opportunity, came the culture and the merchants and all the different things. And they were so successful. And people always say, like, what happened at the end of the Viking Age? There was no end of the Viking Age. They were so successful that they just became absorbed into our society, and also society in France, like in Normandy, the Franks that the Vikings settled in Normandy. William the Conqueror was the descendant of Vikings.
Yeah.
Even our language now, a lot of the words we speak are still Viking words. So they never really, they failed. They just became assimilated.
Yeah.
And eventually they took over the kind of the different royal families. But I think that idea of them being the kind of ultra violent kind of rapers and pillagers is probably accurate, but it's only one facet of a much more nuanced experience in the age that first of all came there. The warriors. After that, then came their families and the settlers and the farmers and the merchants. And I think they were really the pioneers in terms of developing those trade routes with their shallow ships. They were able to sail up rivers, shallow rivers. They were able to sail all the way down from kind of Scandinavia through Russia, right down to Constantinople, and really open up kind of that link between East and West. So I think the view of them just being kind of rapers and pillagers is kind of one-sided, whereas their actual culture was much richer than that.
Yeah, and I must say, I hadn't realised until you mentioned it earlier that they got all the way over to Ireland. So if you know your geography, that's the other side of the British Isles.
Yeah, if you think of Dublin is a Viking town. Dublin was founded kind of by Vikings. Same for Waterford, same for Cork. Even where I live in a town called Kilcullen in Kildare. And there's a little walk you can go on with your kids down by the river. And we only know there's a plaque on the inside of a bridge there to say that the Vikings sailed all the way down the River Liffey and came through that kind of part in the river. So they went far and they did well. And again, I think that's why people are so interested in that subgenre.
Yeah,
is that it's something, and it was something that I struggled with publishers. before I got into the self-publishing journey was that publishers were a little bit narrow in that they want it's got to be either Roman or Napoleonic, or they feel like there's no market for it.
Right. But
clearly, that's not the case. I think the whole Anglo-Saxon slash Viking historical fiction is kind of a thriving subgenre.
Mm.
A lot of the writers I mentioned earlier, who I kind of bid against on Amazon ads and those different things, those guys do really well. You've got Matthew Harvey, Tim Hodkinson, Stephen McKay, all these guys who are kind of super successful. And that's all within that kind of Viking Anglo-Saxon subgenre. So I think there's a huge amount of interest in that. And there will always be.
Yeah. No. Well, we've had the TV series, haven't we, Vikings? Have you had any emails dropped from HBO or Netflix yet?
No, there was some interest there from a kind of a Netflix producer, but it was incredibly exciting for about 3 days, but then there was no response to emails and stuff like that.
Right.
So it kind of faded away, but there was a bit of interest shown. But
I mean, historical fiction is going great guns on TV, isn't it? Not just that era, but obviously in the wake of Game of Thrones, we've had spin-offs and that, but there's also Outlanders doing well again. I think Highlander, they had a series adaptation recently, and there will be more.
Yeah, and like that, I think it really, like Game of Thrones obviously is pure fantasy, but it's set in that kind of, it's set in a pseudo kind of War of the Roses type world, you know. You've got the Vikings TV series, which everybody loves. You kind of have the Wheel of Time on Amazon Prime, which is pure fantasy, but set in a kind of medieval world. You've got The Last Kingdom, which is kind of Bernard Cornwell series. And I think they're actually filming now one of his other series, which was set kind of in the Dark Ages, kind of a King Arthur type story. And those books are actually brilliant. So that'll be a great series. So I think people will always be interested in history, the characters from history, what they did, because it often when you delve into it, it's like when you're writing a historical fiction book, say for me, a lot of the plot comes from the actual history.
Yeah.
So a lot of the most exciting stuff that happens in the books is actually true. Which is great. It's a bit like you, James, I'm sure, when you're researching your books and, you know, you kind of get stuck into the history that you love, researching the planes and the way that the guys flew the planes and the adventures they have. And your plot really comes from the teasing out of that kind of research. And that's the most exciting part of it for me is you kind of read a non-fiction book and stuff that you didn't know jumps out of the page, and that really influences then how your book's going to develop.
It is exactly the same. Yeah, I absolutely love those real incidences, and then my story gets built up around them. It just gives some authenticity to it. And like you, exactly. I mix my reading with thrillers in a similar genre. I always feel I should read more, but I'm so drawn to nonfiction. I read Anthony Beaver and Max Hastings. I'm reading his Cold War, Cuban Missile Crisis nonfiction book at the moment, and that's as important for me as reading, you know, sort of comparable authors.
You need both, right? I think that myself, and I try and be conscious of that. So even though I love reading fantasy, I'll try and mix it up, and every third book will be kind of a nonfiction book. And there are some great ones out there for it. If you're interested in the period, there are some great books out there about the Anglo-Saxons and the Vikings, and a lot of them are on Kindle Unlimited. And if you remember there, you get to read them for free. And like that, it opens up that whole world. And if anybody's interested in writing about the period, a lot of the narrative kind of does jump off the page and really gets your mind working. And that's the great thing about writing historical fiction, right? Is the truth is often stranger than fiction. And
yeah.
It's brilliant.
Absolutely. Well, I love your enthusiasm, Peter. It's been brilliant. I'm so happy that you won that award. I don't think I would, just without knowing any of you, well, in fact, I did know a couple of the nominees, but looking at them, I just wouldn't have picked yours. I wouldn't have expected yours to have won, because it didn't, as you said at the beginning, didn't quite fit into those big genres that do well, that are sort of poster cards for Kindle. So it's absolutely brilliant that you won, and you must have knocked it out of the park with your book. So well done.
Thank you. Thank you. No, listen, I was delighted to win. I think from talking to the guys on the judging panel, retrospectively, I think that perhaps went in my favour, because it's so different. And some of the judging panel actually said to me at the start of the book, they couldn't get into it. And I think it's because their brains are so coded to be reading that world that they write in, which is the crime fiction, yeah. and they're expecting. But equally then, I think once they got hooked into the characters, because, it is kind of exciting. It's kind of, there's a woman warrior in it with one eye kind of jumping around the place like that, but, wielding axes. And how can you not love that, right?
Yeah.
I think it's just...
I'm in.
So I actually think that the difference went in my favour, to be honest.
Yeah. Yes, so I bet a few people started reading it thinking they wouldn't probably take to it because it's so out of their normal area. But well done.
And thanks. And it would be out of the norm. But like I said, what I try and do is take that macro event, but also have the characters that you can relate, their interactions and their relationships are kind of the same as ours on a daily basis.
Well, that's what a couple of judges said to me when I spoke to one in the evening. They forgot they were reading a Viking book in the middle of it. They found it so gripping. So, and it's good luck with your I can say sort of retirement. It's not retirement at all. Your transition into being a full-time author. And, we wish you well.
Thank you. And thanks very much for your time. It's great to be part of the podcast because, like I say, I've always listened to it and learned a lot from you guys. So thanks.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go. Well done, Peter Gibbons, Kindle Storyteller Award winner for 2022. Of course, Ian W. Sainsbury is a former winner. He's one of our Fuse Books authors. Claire Lydon, well done, Claire, I should say. She got nominated as well. It's,
and
always comes to our conferences, and I keep her entertained with my wit whenever we're in the bar.
Yes, with slightly kind of spoiling myself in terms of... spoiling news that I might release later when it comes to the conference. One of the things we probably are going to have in June is all of the Kindle Storyteller Awards award winners on a panel. That's something I've been talking about with Amazon, provided they can all come, of course, or at least as many of them as we can get. I think it'd be quite interesting to talk about, where they were, what happened. Some of them won during the pandemic, for example, so couldn't go to the... I remember seeing a couple of kind of virtual award shows, and this was the first one at Westminster, where we had to queue for about an hour to get in.
Yeah, in the rain.
In the rain, yeah. See how their careers have gone since then. So, that'll be fun. I'll be looking forward to seeing that one.
Yep.
That session.
We'll talk about the conference, I think, a bit more in the next couple of weeks. We've just passed the early bird pricing point, so it's now at full price, but it's still an absolute bargain, it's I think, for what you get. And, we've seen conferences put on... Single-day conferences put on by LBF for writers at £500, £495, I think, for the day.
It's crazy.
Ours is a fraction of that, and it's all indie, so I'm looking forward to that. But that's in the background. We'll talk about that in the future. Thank you very much indeed to Peter Gibbons. Congratulations again, Peter. Great to speak to you, and hopefully see you in London in June. And thank you to the team in the background for putting the show together. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, me. Who thanks me? Thank me.
No one thanks you.
So it's a thankless job. Anyway, that's it. All that remains for me to say is a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with The Self-Publishing Show.